Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly movie podcast. I'm Eric Cohn, the executive editor and chief critic, and normally I'd be joined by our editor-at-large, Ann Thompson, but she's using this small window of time in between the end of the first nomination voting period for the Oscars and Oscar nomination morning to get some much-needed R&R. So I'm very happy to have our guest today, Tom Brueggemann, our box office analyst, who some listeners may recall from previous episodes. Because Tom, it's great to have you here. First of all, welcome. Thanks for coming back. I know it went well before. Yeah, so we're really happy to have you because we're living through such a strange period in terms of box office and exhibition. And so every few months brings a new stage of the conversation. But one of the things that I think is really important to talk about now is that every time we sort of circle back on the conversation about the future of movie going, it seems like attitudes have shifted a little bit. And it is a fluid situation that often seems quite dire, but movie theaters do seem to be opening. And last Friday, New York City got its green light to reopen, and we're seeing more and more art houses sort of approach that situation. So what is your read now? If you were to say, compare it to where we were a couple months ago, in terms of the state of things, does it seem like we're heading in a positive direction?
Well, we're definitely in a positive direction. Let me say from the start, as a caveat, William Goldman's famous phrase about the film industry, nobody knows anything, or whatever the exact words were. This is not a clear period. This is totally uncharted. Yeah. Anybody who tells you that they know what's going to happen is either has a vested interest in it or is naive. I've been in the industry for multiple decades. I've been doing this as an analyst for almost a decade. And I say up front, I'm not sure what's going to happen. I think the point of how it's different from 2-3 months ago, I expected we would always get at this point. I didn't think that we were going to be in a situation that theaters wouldn't reopen. There's enough demand. I mean, there certainly is enough infrastructure and interest around the world that the United States wouldn't be set apart. And there's just too much vested interest in existing theaters, not just from the exhibitors, but also landlords and communities that they draw people into. As well as the fact that so many of the structures can't be used for anything else. This was always going to happen. But if you're going to go from the perspective of 2-3 months ago, I think every day that theaters don't get open makes it more difficult for business to return as normal, because business from the start has moved on. The business from the distribution side has moved on. They found alternative ways to play movies. And, that's been the real stress, that you can't wait forever, apart from the financial losses that so many companies are taking, that the audience has shifted and their expectations have shifted so much.
But let's look at this on a more specific level, because on the one hand, you have the multiplexes that just need the scale to really make this worth the effort. But then you have the art houses where, until a few weeks ago, it was unclear how New York City art houses would have any way forward. Then they were given 25% capacity, which still isn't a real way forward, because you're not making money when you have, say 300 seats in a theater and you can only fill 25% of them. So for the multiplexes, what needs to happen for the theatrical business to seem sustainable again? And then we can dig deeper into these smaller players.
Well, I think the capacity issue outside of a select number of places is not an issue. Most of the country is not at 25% anyway, if they're open. And most, if there aren't enough seats in an individual auditorium, multiplexes have the capacity of playing on multiple screens so they can make up for that. And at first, there aren't going to be, assuming Black Widow goes on May 7th, it's going to be close to what the situation was in September. It can have 8 screens in a 14 screen complex. So that in Manhattan, it did make a difference. What's going to have to happen is that either studios are going to have to restrained from utilizing the the decreased window gaps that they have, which is very questionable, and that the public accepts that movie theaters are the prime place to come back and see movies, which is...
Well, I thought it was interesting that Tom and Jerry, I mean, in a relative universe in which box office numbers are not huge, Tom and Jerry did pretty well, even though it was on HBO Max. And it does seem like, before with Day and Date, when you were talking about putting a movie at IFC Center that people could watch at home, well, a lot of people just are in the habit of going to a movie theater to see an art house movie, and maybe they know it's on VOD, maybe they don't, they have a relationship to that experience. But when the assumption before this was a bigger studio release, they don't have that relationship. If they can watch it at home, they're going to watch it at home. And it seems like the Tom and Jerry case study, as small scale as it was, would imply otherwise. So you think about something like Black Widow, it does make me wonder if there's enough of a demand to see that movie. I mean, certainly we haven't had something on that level of excitement come into theaters in a year and change. So maybe even with a diminished window, it could still deliver theatrically. I mean, that must be the gamble that Disney is talking through right now, right?
Right. And again, to the point of we don't know anything yet and what's going to happen, my sense is that a great deal of the regular movie-going audience, when for every movie that comes out, is going to, many people are going to ask the question, when will it be available at home? Why won't it be available at home? Mm-hmm. One of the most dramatic shifts that happened in the business in the last year is that for decades, there has been, and everybody does everything the same way with nuances for different types of films in releasing films. Now, it's varied from what happened pre-Jaws to what happened after Jaws. It's, changed over the years. But generally, any given movie in the past, a Black Widow, every studio would have released exactly the same way. That's not the case anymore. Now we're in a situation where each studio has its own model, its own alternatives. Mm-hmm. And that's causing confusion. I mean, I'll give you an example of a close friend of mine who's out of the business. We talk about movies a lot. We talked a couple of weeks ago, and he was very upset because he wanted to see News of the World. And he's an Amazon Prime customer. And he went to Amazon Prime. And he said, it's $19.99. What a ripoff. Why is that the case? He assumed he's an Amazon Prime customer. Yeah. He would be able to get it free. And I had to explain, well, Amazon Prime is a platform. They have their own films that subscribers get, but they also are a platform that video on demand films will be available as well. And they haven't.
I had that same conversation. I remember almost a year ago when Never Rarely Sometimes Always, when the theatrical release was interrupted, and I was trying to tell people, you should watch this movie. It's a great movie, and there's only one way really to see it. And then they would sound intrigued and go see that price tag and say, forget it. Why would I do it? Which is ironic, because if it was a couple, they'd be spending that or more at the theater, but that's the way it goes.
Yeah, I mean, and nobody's certain about this. So I wrote about it on Sunday. Raya and The Lost Dragon was disappointing. For a bunch of reasons, maybe because it came out the week after Tom and Jerry. It came out the same weekend that SpongeBob went on premium VODs. There was more competition. It was less known. But in my mind, I have the sense that when Disney Plus had Soul free for subscribers on Christmas Day, that putting Raya at $29.99 price offended a lot of people. And, did they vote with not purchasing it and then not going to the theaters? Because you can look now on Disney Plus, I believe. I know Mulan is available for subscribers. I'm not sure if Soul is yet. Yeah, Raya is going to be available on Disney Plus in a couple of months for free.
Yeah, and it's also not – I went as an experiment. I watched it that way. I paid the extra money. I didn't have the chance or the bandwidth or whatever to get it through the other avenues that I have as a privileged writer who can get that kind of access. So I tried it out, and what I was thinking when I was watching it is, it's a good movie in parts. It's not exceptional in a way that felt like it justifies that kind of investment. And that seems to be the challenge here. You have to have such a strong desire for this particular experience. And when that experience is framed with all of these other options, why would you spend the extra money? I mean, something like that where it's on Disney Plus. Well, if you're already a subscriber and you want to watch something with your kids, you have a huge catalog of options. So a new release is almost irrelevant.
Right, exactly. And then this same weekend, Coming to America, the sequel came on Amazon Prime for free. Yeah. The anecdotal and somewhat from companies that claim that they have access to these things, say that it was the biggest, most watched movie on any platform in the last year on its debut weekend. You know, that satisfies people. It's not necessarily a family film, although I suspect a lot of families watched it. That's the things that level of stuff is up against. But then you throw in theaters coming back again.
Yeah.
What's going to be people's mindset? I don't buy the idea that open the doors and people are going to flock in because they're so happy. I do buy that there's a substantial audience that feels that way. But I also suspect there are a lot of people, once they can start doing other activities, you know, after spending a year watching more movies than they ever have in their lives, mm-hmm. and then spending indoors, is going indoors to see a movie going to be as high a priority? It may be. We don't know yet. And again, the problem for the theater business is that despite all the hype of 2019 being a record year, which is only based on inflation, it was an okay year compared to the previous year. But in terms of total tickets sold, things have plateaued for a while and they're quite a bit down from the peak. It's not a business that, if you had said a year ago, business will be down 20%, total box office will be down 20%, that would have been a disaster. Now, if it's down 20%, it'll seem like a miracle.
But
the problem is that the finances remain the same.
Yeah.
Now, the way it works is the possibility, the reality, that quite a few, you know, sticking with the first one, studio theaters, that a whole bunch of them aren't going to reopen. And there'll be fewer theaters. If that happens in a dramatic enough fashion, and it's going to be a case-by-case situation, since for the most part, closing wide play theaters are located where fairly close, within driving distance, there's another one playing the same movies, it's possible that those theaters that survive, that continue, might pick up enough of that business so that their individual finances won't be as badly affected if business goes down 20%. That's another unknown.
Yeah, but so that leads into, I think, this fascinating contrast with the art house market, because the numbers are just so totally different. You're dealing with probably, you know, less overhead, but also just a different kind of model in terms of how these movies make money and how theaters stay in business. Here in New York, which got the green light a week before March 5th, then on March 5th, theaters could reopen. It's been a very gradual process because, again, it's if you don't have a lot of seats, then 25% isn't enough. If your theater workers can't get vaccinated, which so far they can't, it's not necessarily worth the risk. But we are seeing moves toward sort of experiments with reopening. IFC Center, Film Forum around the corner. We expect MoMA and Lincoln Center sometime soon will give us their timelines. And the way in which movies come out that are, you know, awards contenders, international cinema, they're very reliant on the New York market. Just historically, that's always been the case. What's it going to take for the New York market to sort of regain its foothold and launch films in any way like it could before?
Well, again, you know, it's New York and L.A. that have simultaneously set the tone, and usually for most films, the same date. Although there's much, you know, greater differences, there's more seating in L.A. At the appropriate theaters. The big question for Specialized has operated on a different model. I said at the start that there have been set models of movies have been released, but nuances within them. One of the nuances, as you know, most people are aware, is that a Specialized film, i.e. Nomadland or Minari under the old rules, would have opened up in New York and Los Angeles initially, maybe two theaters. I can almost tell you which theaters they would have been. Play for a week. Then second week, 5 to 10 other cities joined in, mostly exclusively. The third week, a little bit more, depending on whether would they open up around the holiday and trying to maximize on holidays or where they were in relationship to Oscar nominations.
Yeah.
They expanded. So it was a slow, gradual process. Now that's at odds with this new expanded window model. Netflix, of all people, sort of set the tone with this when they set up a 3-week window on their awards contending films in past years, like Roma and Irishman, where they opened up in New York and LA, I think one case San Francisco, 3 weeks before their date, added some theaters 2 weeks before the date, more 1 week before the date, and continued adding on theaters when the film went on Netflix. That model, those weren't expected to gross all that much. It was, it's not a prime player, and a lot of exhibitors, although not so much the Specialized ones, resisted that. Now, and the reason for doing that is that it allowed the possibility without mass TV buys to build up word of mouth, to be able to have one of the things affecting my job is that people look at per theater averages, and that's an apples and oranges comparison so much of the time, but distributors are afraid quite often to open up in 5 or 6 theaters the first week because New York and LA do so much better than everybody else and people will misinterpret them. I hope all that stuff goes by the side. That can be very, even though it relates to what I write about, that can be so misleading and can hurt the overall situation. I think it's a good thing if Specialized learns how to use marketing. A lot of the companies know how to do this a lot, but knows how to do social media and makes an attempt to elevate this, that they will speed up the weeks, that they will go more theaters the first week, double or triple the number the second week, wide the third week. For the major films.
So then the concept of the platform release has to evolve, basically, is what you're saying.
Yeah, and that's been very static. I mean, there have been some minor increases in that, but it's so much of the best grosses come from the time of the year of the awards, and that's been so tied in with when the nominations are and maximizing, going wider at that point. Usually in recent years, by the time the awards come in late February, early March, films are mostly out on at least BVOD, which is after 70, 72 days. But this year is entirely different. You can't make any sense out of this year. Except that everything that's going to be nominated in all but possibly foreign language film, and I'm not sure about that, everything by the 1st of April will be available to see at home after the nominations, before the awards. That's unprecedented.
Which is awesome, by the way. I mean, honestly, that's always been this frustrating challenge. It's like you want to use the Oscars as a platform to get people aware of a wider array of options, including films like even something like Nomadland is not a movie that I would say general audiences get really enthusiastic about. But if they can watch it at home, then great. So I'm curious to know what kind of a bump that has across the board beyond, say, the Best Picture nominations. But
yeah,
that is very interesting.
Yeah. But again, that's a challenge because, again, the margins for Specialized theaters are so small this is the way this all shakes out remains to be seen. There are fewer theaters, in some cases, Specialized theaters may have less competition. If there, it may be that is up to distributors, but distributors may try to keep these theaters alive by giving them a little bit more exclusivity over the round the corner wider, you know, chain theater. But that's very difficult to pull off because those chains, if a film is successful, provide a huge amount of the income in later weeks, and you can upset them by not giving them a piece of the action fairly early on if they have viable theaters in many markets. But anyway, it's a very complicated situation. I would say, again, there is real danger to specialize. The good thing is that the aid packages that have come out benefited a lot of the small theaters because if you're a small operation, you qualify. I don't believe that a prime circuit like Landmark has qualified. I'm not 100% certain by that. And there's ways that you can have theaters as individual corporations that they might be able to, it's still all being worked out.
Thorny situation, yeah. But the other thing is that's fascinating about what you're saying is that it's reliant on this idea that more theaters could equal more money or more success in terms of the way these films launch across the country. But every state is different. I mean, certainly in a weird sort of way, there's an opportunity in a place like Texas right now where it's like they're basically saying, go outside and pretend like the pandemic never happened. And, you know, if you could release in theaters all over that state, maybe you have an opportunity, but there are other places where, you know, the mood differs. So it's a very complex sort of question of like how widely could you launch something?
Well, we start off with the proposition that specialized theaters have been more willing to play with home platforms. You know, a lot of them played Netflix. Landmark played Netflix a lot of places. And so that resistance was already broken down. If you remember back a few years ago when Sony's The Interview was pirated by the North Koreans, it was specialized theaters to keep on that and did a fair amount of business because a lot of the chains refused to play it. But, you know, you're talking about a group that, although it's, Parasite got an awful lot of younger viewers. A lot of the Wes Anderson film was going to hope for that coming up. But the core audience is still older. And that audience, you know, two things has happened. They may still be more reluctant to go back to theaters. And unlike a lot of the younger audience, the last year has been a learning experience for them for seeing films at home where they might not have ever bought a movie or rented a movie from a service in the past. You know, might have had Netflix or Amazon Prime, but the idea of going out, you know, that, and they've learned how to do that.
All right, so that's a big deal. So, but this leads into the other thing we should talk about, which is what theater owners have had to learn in the past year, which is how to release movies digitally with the concept of virtual cinema.
Yeah.
Now, you reported this week on some numbers from Kino Lorber, which made a little over $1 million, they're saying, in terms of virtual cinema releases, about $1 million less than they did theatrically the year prior. But for a smaller company that distributes a wide range of cinema from around the world, that is not an easy sell. That is something. And half of that presumably something like half of that is going to the theaters as well. At the same time, I got Karen Cooper from Film Forum telling me, anybody who tells you that these are real numbers is not being honest. And I think that what we're seeing is that probably some really smart, business savvy people have figured out a way to pivot to digital releases, because especially somebody like Kino that already does that as part of their business would understand it. But for independent theater owners, that's just not the business that they're in. So the question is, just how much do they need to look at virtual cinema as this supplementary revenue stream in the long term, when I think most of them are probably more inclined to hope they can just cut it off, pretend it never happened, so that people realize like that was a temporary fix and they have to go back to the theater now?
Yeah, I mean, this predates the pandemic. IFC and Magnolia for years have had a steady supply of films that come out at the same time, although both distributors have isolated some of their top titles with theatrical potential for a further delay before doing that.
Right.
But yeah, no, it's here.
They invented that game. I mean, before anybody else was.
Yeah. Roadside with Margin Call and
Oh yes, Margin Call was huge.
Early on, were important almost a decade ago. How it coexists, it's very difficult. As far as the revenues, Film Forum, which is such a large grossing place, may not be the best example, because what they gross by being huge to somebody else. My sense is it's been better for distributors than it has been for individual exhibitors. But remember that a well-run platform, Lemley Theatres out here in Los Angeles, which is an important local specialized chain, pretty much the main game for subtitled films, put together a very strong platform. It's a lot of films, and a lot. If it adds together eventually. On the other hand, they've got a dozen theaters or so. So it's like not. It's not like that's anywhere close to possible to being able to replicate that sort of revenue. I think generally because the margins on specialized films, the need to recoup what you put into it is relatively small, that there's going to be incentive for most of the specialized distributors to continue the option of having alternatives. It's going to depend on how much people are willing to pay. We don't know. Searchlight has been incredibly stubborn about giving any numbers on Nomadland and how many views it's had on Hulu. They totally withheld more than any other distributor numbers and theaters on the film, which we've been able to get from other sources, and they're not good, but it doesn't matter. I mean, it's just, it doesn't count.
My guess with Nomadland would be good, maybe not exceptional. I mean, someone might get mad that I would guess that, but what can we do when we don't see it?
That would have been my assumption, but I got an email yesterday from, again, I don't know how accurate they are, but a service that monitors views from at least some percentage of the audience, and for the weekend, Coming to America was one, SpongeBob was two. If I recall correctly, Nomadland was three, or it might have been five. The first Coming to America was fourth, believe it or not. And if that's the case, it's getting a lot of views. And that increases its value to Hulu. And at this point, we're talking about, as we should, the conflicts between theaters and studios and their relationship. Yeah. But that's not the only game going on right now. There's all these other games going on. It's a game between video and demand and streaming as a model. And it's a game between, premium VOD and regular VOD for certain titles that can go either way. It's a game between different streamers and what they are competitively doing from different priorities, different abilities. There's speculation. I don't know. This is not something I've researched, but I read someplace that the reason Paramount Plus was rushed is that overall the company is in play and its value increases if it had a platform. But if that's their prime incentive, it might be of interest to them to, reach out and purchase a film for a really ridiculous amount of money.
They really missed out on not holding on to Coming to America, and they sold it off to a streamer a year
ago.
That's
interesting. Yeah, I mean, they sold it off at $125 million, supposedly, for a film that cost $60 million, and then they didn't have to spend marketing on it, around the world, another $50 million. So that's a huge profit. That's a loss for theaters. SpongeBob, it waited until April. Why couldn't it have waited another month and gone in theaters? But again, we that's part of the frustration for me in my job, because we don't have access to these figures. It's tough sometimes, even when you get box office theatrical results, to really say for sure what they mean, because we don't know for sure what the film rental is. We don't know for sure what the marketing is. We don't know if the production costs are accurate. We don't know, what the ancillary deals are and how that kicks in. But you have a general idea of what works and doesn't work. What we're left with right now is to seeing what actions people take, sort of define what's working and what's not working. And even then, we're not absolutely certain because there are other motivations, competitive motivations for doing things. Now, the reality is a lot of the smaller specialized films, particularly the subtitled films, Parasite, an incredible exception, are not going to be more than, in conventional times, more than $1 million grocers. So they may be left relatively untouched. Problem is that the core specialized theaters rely on films like Offspring, rely on films like Coda, they rely on films that certainly like Nomadland.
Are now becoming these streaming entities.
Yeah, like now, Nomadland Apple, was a Searchlight film, so that's exception. Yeah. But when they go to Apple or Amazon or Netflix initially, they're going to have, even though there's talk that Apple and Amazon are going to release these films, the incentive is going to be to get them out and get them out quickly. And if the chains are willing to play them, it's hard to see how the chains can refuse to play Apple and Netflix and Amazon if they're going to be available 3 weeks later when they're playing Warner Brothers Day and Date. They can't do whatever they want. At some point, they could run into legal problems. But if once that happens, those films are going to be, and the business involved is going to be less available for the core specialized theaters. And the core specialized theaters survive on the top grossing films and getting as much of their share of that income, their revenue as possible. So
as much as those of us who might say, New York is a great place to have independent theaters because of all the repertory work that they can show, seeing film form gradually come back is so exciting. But even those places, by and large, rely on first run stuff that might not need this model anymore.
Right.
So it's a fascinating open question for the future. Before we wrap up, I wanted to get a chance to humanize you a bit because the box office routine. No, but look, you're sitting in front of a Godard poster. You are a cinephile, and I think sometimes the challenge with what work that you do and that other industry reporters do is that you're talking about numbers. You're not talking about art and culture, even though that is tied into these things. I'm curious to know what you've had a chance to see. I mean, the Oscar nominations are coming on Monday morning, and our colleague Ann Thompson will have her final pick soon. But the real question is, what do you want to happen? Not how's all the stuff that's happened in the past year going to play a role in terms of the visibility and all that kind of stuff. So, I mean, how much have you seen? What are you pulling for? What are some highlights for you?
Well, this is very complicated. We haven't discussed this up front, so this is going to surprise you a little bit. For me individually, one of the biggest aspects of the pandemic is that I've had a greatly decreased interest in movies, and I'm having a hard time having an ability to focus and watch movies. I've actually started switching to multi-hour reading every evening, the evenings I have available, and finding that much more satisfying than the movie experience. I've seen an incredible number of movies in my life. So there are always more things to see.
You could take a year off and you'd still have a head full of cinema.
Exactly. Having a break is certain. I mean, I can live without it. When you deal with mortality, it's, oh my God, movies are going to be out there after I'm not here anymore. I actually have not, as far as the Oscars are concerned, this will be the first year that in many years that I will not have seen all of the top nominees by the time of the that they come out. And frankly, there's a film that's in the running for Best Picture that I saw 20 minutes of months ago and stopped. And even if it was Best Picture, it's just sort of like in my mind, okay, I don't have to see this. I don't have to see everything. It's a very, very tough year. Let me put it this way. I know a lot of people watching, certainly the IndieWire world internally and externally is very excited for good reason with what's going to be nominated this year. There's a diversity. There's so many independent films. And, you know, for the most part, I've preferred this sort of nominee to the studio nominees over, you know, the recent years. Not entirely across the board. I was a huge fan of Gravity. I thought that it should have won rather than what did that here. Think of a world, and this is probably a good thought for thinking about how the world, the outside world, is reacting overall.
Yeah,
the world that is excited about the nominees, how would they feel if, for some reason, it ended up that only films that had grossed over 100 million could be nominated for Oscars? Which is really
sort of the equivalent. Well, I don't know. It's funny. I don't know if you listened to when Tom Quinn was our guest last week. He was saying he's on this track about how every Oscar contender must report box office to qualify. And I feel like that's going to be a pretty hard bar to get to. But also, it's like, what would that tell you? It would tell you on a regular basis how few of the movies that we get really excited about actually perform for a mass audience. And that's a disconnect culturally.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this is a strange year, and, you know, I admire the Academy for making every effort to make sure it happens as it is going to happen. And they've got a, you know, strong producing team behind them. Let's report that they may try to do it at Union Station, which is a spectacular place.
It's a cool idea.
I mean, that's very interesting, but it's an asterisk year, and it's as it would be the other direction. I think it's hard not to do this. So that's muted my interest. I think, you know, from a personal standpoint, because I spend from October through the awards particularly in my specialized report, back when there was a specialized box office report on Sunday, analyzing what the impact and trying to explain why a film's going where it is, how it's doing compared to other films, you know, I miss that. And so maybe there's part of me that just isn't invested in the race as much as I have been other times.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I also think that if the Best Picture conversation was centered on the movies that actually don't tend to generate headlines around Oscar season, which is to say the international films, like if we were all talking about, is it going to be another round or The Mole Agent versus Minari, which could actually get a Best Picture nominated, it would be fascinating for us, because I think even somebody like you, who's maybe feeling okay about not watching all these things, might feel more compelled on a regular basis based on the reminders that are out there. And one of the things we're just getting reminded of is that there's a lot of the movies that end up getting all this attention for Best Picture, they're not necessarily something that's going to change your life, that you need to drop everything and do, and you will get a better aesthetic experience from the book that you're reading right now. So you may as well just go that route. And I do wonder if there is this sort of existential question with the Oscars, where it's like, if the Oscars can figure out a sustainable way to be relevant without nominating the biggest movies that everyone has seen for the biggest categories, then we'll have it'll have a better impact in terms of the kind of films we can celebrate and talk about on a regular basis.
Definitely going to change things. I mean, this is I'm really befuddled. And actually, one of the movies to make a confession that I haven't seen is Tenet. I'm befuddled that Tenet hasn't shown up in the crafts. You'd think this is the year, and certainly Warner's and Nolan intended this, that by being out there, you know, being fairly successful, it's hugely successful on all platforms. It's more than 6 months after the film came out, and it's still charting fairly high on a $5.99 price. It's that isn't a automatic Best Picture nominee, and maybe that ends up happening. Although I don't think.
But Tom, I gotta tell you, I mean, this is a good note to end on. Is that movie is so underwhelming in spite of everything, that at the end of the day, quality still means something. So however bad this mysterious Best Picture contender you turned off after 20 minutes was, it probably was still better than Tenet. And I keep pushing for this awareness. It sounds very naive, but quality matters at every level of the industry. A really great movie that people are excited about can have a really strong marketing campaign about it, around it, whether it's a big studio movie or a really small independent, whether it's driven by word of mouth or $100 million, that quality element should still matter. And I feel like if we don't emphasize that enough. It's very easy for that to be an elusive aspect of the equation. But it's that is, to me, why Tenet is not an Oscar movie. It's just not good enough, no matter how you spin it.
And clearly, that just didn't resonate with people. And you have to have some heart. And you have to have some fan base to be nominated. Just to tie some stuff together, because I think this is sort of relevant, because both Tenet and clearly Wonder Woman 1984 seem to have disappointed people. People are putting their faith so much that Black Widow, that Cruella, that when it comes out down the line, No Time to Die, F9, are going to be big films. What if they are underwhelming? You know, how much that is, you hope.
At least one of those movies probably will be, so.
Actually, the film I think is a slam dunk for biggest around the world is F9. To me, that has always been the film that made sense to go out first, big. Now, they're set in a situation where I think they're 3 weeks after Black Widow in a holiday weekend in the United States. But that's going to be the test. But and that's sort of, nothing's foolproof, but that's probably a little bit more foolproof. It's everybody's optimistic and everybody should be optimistic and everybody should be pulling for success. And everybody, you know, certainly somebody like me needs to be sympathetic and understanding and not compare too rigidly against past standards, even if we point out, you know, shortfalls. But the films have to be there, not just on paper. And, you know, we don't know that because we haven't seen them yet.
Well, Tom, I will leave you to your reading hours, but I hope to win you back at the movies sometime soon, whether it'll be at Palm Springs or back here in New York. But we'll get there one way or another, and it's great to hear that, you know, you're feeling at least optimistic in context. So thanks again for being here, and we'll have to do this again sometime soon, with or without Anne.
All right, my pleasure.